Today at Reader's Corner, Mark Levinson, author of An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Postwar Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The decades after World War II were a golden age when many people around the world enjoyed an increasingly good quality of life. But by the early 1970s, the good times had all but vanished as energy shortages, financial crises, and rising unemployment shook economies in America and around the world. In his latest book, titled An Extraordinary Time, Mark Levinson describes how economists and governments struggled to find the pathway back to a time when jobs were plentiful and living standards improved year after year. But they were unable to do so. Decades later, we can only look back to a post-war prosperity that Dr. Levinson suggests may never return. Mark Levinson is the former finance and economics editor for The Economist and the author of six books. He was a guest on our show in 2015 to discuss his earlier book, The Great A&P and the Struggle for Small Business in America. Dr. Levinson joins us today from Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. Mark Levinson, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you for having me.
Well, Mark, let's start with some real basics here. I think I minored in econ once upon a time, but it was once upon a time, and therefore I'm going to ask a very basic question. I think I understand something about measuring the U.S. economy. I would go right to GNP or whatever we call it these days. I might look at the stock market and see how it's doing lately. But when it comes to the world economy, what are the metrics? What do you use to measure the world economy?
Well, I think that you use a concept similar to a GDP, gross domestic product, here in the United States. It has to be said right up front that GDP is not the measure of everything that one might care about in an economy. It doesn't measure how happy people are. It doesn't measure how good you feel going to work every morning. It doesn't measure your health. It measures certain things that we can measure about the state of an economy. So if you try and add up all of the economic output in the world over the course of a year, that's GDP. What my book discusses is that over roughly a quarter century, between 1948 and 1973, the world had the fastest economic growth probably at any time in human history. And that's something we've struggled to replicate ever since.
So why do we give up on a world economy that was experiencing such a post-war boom?
I don't say that we should give up on it by any stretch. What I would argue is that we came to see the post-war boom as normal. During the quarter century I was referring to, economists refer to it as the golden age, the world economy grew at a rate of about 5% every year. Now, just to put that in terms that people can understand, if the economy is growing at 5% a year, then people's incomes are going to double in roughly 14 years. They're going to quadruple in roughly 28 years. This is growth that's fast enough that people can feel themselves getting better off year after year. They can feel their living standards rising. And we certainly had this in the United States during the post-war period. This was the period in which many people moved from being urban apartment dwellers to having their own homes in the suburbs. This was the period in which many people were able to buy cars and washing machines, television sets, things that were previously unaffordable luxuries, and they became available to average families. This is what I mean by rising living standards. And the post-war period saw living standards rising faster than at any time before or since.
So at what point, you mentioned the year, but let's talk about that year. At what point do you see this transformation of this post-war economy, the here, the there, and the now? I think you said it was 1973.
The boom ended pretty abruptly in 1973, right at the end of the year. We went into 1973 with very high growth expectations, and indeed, 1973 was probably the year that had the fastest economic growth the world has ever seen. The world economy was truly functioning on all cylinders. That was also the year when we started to have the OPEC oil crisis that some of your listeners may remember. We had an oil boycott in the autumn of that year following the outbreak of the Yom Kippur War in the Middle East, when many of the Arab oil exporters put an embargo on shipments to the United States, to the Netherlands, and several other countries. And that really set off a chain of events that led to a very sharp drop in economic growth. It led to a recession, following which we never really recovered. At the time, of course, a lot of people blamed these developments on the oil crisis itself. But as I discuss in the book, there were actually some other important things going on behind the scenes that led to this boom coming to an end at the end of 1973.
And let's talk about some of those. You discuss the dramatic shift from the good times of the golden age and talk about a number of issues that changed: the minimum wage, regulations, international trade agreements. If you could expand on some of those.
Sure. I don't want to bore your readers with a lot of macroeconomic stuff, but let me just give a very brief explanation here about economic growth. You can think about economic growth as having two parts. One is the population growth, the growth in the number of workers. The second is what we call productivity. And a good way to think about productivity is how much a person can produce in an hour of work. That's essentially the non-technical definition of productivity. In the period after World War II, we saw remarkably fast productivity growth. Why was this? Well, because there were a number of things that happened that made it easy to raise productivity growth very quickly in the post-war period. Let me give you just a couple of examples. At the end of World War II here in the United States, we had, believe it or not, more than 3 million mules on farms. We had millions of people whose work was every day to go and walk behind a mule plowing a field. That's pretty low productivity work. We were able in the post-war period to move many of those people into much higher productivity jobs in factories, for example, where they could produce much more wealth in an hour of work, and the American people got a good share of that wealth. Another example was that at the time the war ended, domestic transportation in the United States didn't work very well. The highways were two-lane roads by and large. They were very crowded. It could take a week or more to drive from coast to coast. So we embarked in the 1950s on this program to build the interstate highways. Most of that construction occurred in the 50s and the 60s, and the interstate highway system had a remarkable impact on economic growth. Firms could sell into much larger markets. They could deliver their goods to many more people, and workers had a much broader choice of jobs because they could commute further on the expressway. So that contributed to huge economic growth.
If I can stop you right there and have you just elaborate on the technology issue. Instead of that guy following the mule, he hopped on a tractor. And, of course, that's technological advancement, which is one of the points you're making about that era. But in those days, it doesn't seem as though the technology is replacing the individual. He's just getting from behind the mule and jumping on the tractor, as opposed to today where that's not the case. Is that right?
You're quite right about that. The guy who had been walking behind the mule moved to Chicago and got a job in a factory. Okay, we had a very large increase in manufacturing employment, and so there were plenty of jobs available to soak up people who maybe didn't have a lot of education and training, but who had the ability to do hard work. And that was absolutely a factor in the productivity growth of the post-war period. As your listeners know very well, those kind of jobs are in short supply these days.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Mark Levinson, author of An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Postwar Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. So, again, getting back to some of the other changes over recent years, and by recent years, I mean going all the way back to 1973, let's talk for a moment about energy, about regulation, about environmental concerns that crop up, international trade agreements. Maybe you could just take those apart for us one by one, show us how that contributes to a very different economy today than the one we enjoyed in post-World War II days.
I'm happy to talk about that. I need to, I think, make an important point before I do, which is that my book is deliberately an international book. And the reason for that is that when people talk about something they don't like in the economy, it's slowing down, there's higher unemployment, whatever it is, they tend to blame that on something they know and don't like. Okay, we're going to blame that on this regulation. We're going to blame that on the health care plan that is killing jobs, whatever it is. But the trends I'm discussing in An Extraordinary Time, the growth slowdown around the world are really international trends. So you need to look beyond a single factor in a single country. There are clearly some very broad-based factors at work here. The most important one, as I suggest in my book, is that a lot of the low-hanging fruit was picked. Okay, all of the major countries, all of the wealthy economies, built their expressways. They all spent a lot of money improving their schools in the post-war period and increasing university enrollments very rapidly. They all saw workers moving from peasant farming or sharecropping into urban jobs with higher productivity. These were all trends, and the trends came to an end in all of the wealthy economies. So this is not just a U.S.-specific thing, but in fact is a very global thing. Regulations definitely play a part in that. One of the things that I think has been interesting around the world is that as economies grow wealthier, as individuals grow wealthier, they start to ask questions about how important is economic growth relative to other things we care about. Maybe we think economic growth has come at the expense of the environment, so we want to have more environmental regulations. Maybe we think economic growth hasn't benefited workers enough, and so we want to reward the workers with shorter work weeks. All of those types of measures have some value, perhaps, but they also can have the effect of slowing down the rate at which productivity rises.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because as I read your book, I thought it would be too easy for a very simplistic analysis of this to wind up on the side of, well, then we shouldn't have had all that regulation. Well, then we shouldn't have been concerned about the environment. Well, then, in essence, what you're saying is we shouldn't have extended the lives of people who live on this earth over recent years. And of course, that's absurd. The welfare state itself, even though that has become somewhat of a negative term, the welfare state itself is about programs like Medicaid, providing poor access to health care for the poor. That once upon a time didn't happen. But your point in this book is that there are some costs to that, but they may be costs that a society just has to incur?
Yes, that's right. Your older readers, your listeners rather, may remember a book that came out right around the time I'm talking about in 1972, 73, a book called The Limits to Growth. This was a blockbuster. This was a book that sold 12 million copies. And what it said was, we can't grow anymore. We're taxing our environment to the breaking point. And so we're going to have an economic collapse in not just the United States, but in all the world. Well, there were a lot of people who were worried about this, frankly, in the early 1970s. They saw the end coming because the environment was too stressed. And so this was part of the ideology that was becoming important in that period. Nobody cared about those sorts of things in 1948, but by 1973, there were a lot of people out there saying, hey, maybe economic growth isn't such a great idea, if you can believe that. Of course, what happened subsequently is we found that you can't just run these projections and say that, oh, the world is going to run out of iron next year. It doesn't work like that.
So tell us what Nixon did as a result of that Limits to Growth study, or maybe it wasn't a direct result of that, but he went to Congress and asked for something himself.
Well, people may remember that we started to have a serious inflation problem back in the late 1960s or the early 1970s, and then it became even more severe later on. In country after country, including the United States, the first response to address inflation was to freeze prices. Yes, we had a price freeze in the United States. Nixon obtained approval for a commission that was going to decide how much prices should be able to go up, who was entitled to how much of a wage increase. The government was going to determine whether that wage increase was acceptable or whether it was inflationary. And no one was really willing to deal with this with the difficult sort of medicine that came later. It was firmly believed that there was a permanent trade-off between the inflation rate and the unemployment rate. So if we were not willing to accept high inflation, then we were going to have to live with high unemployment forever. That was really the ideology through most of the 1980s in many countries. It took Paul Volcker coming along in the early 1980s to say, this is nonsense. We're going to put a stop to inflation, and Volcker did it.
So you've discussed environmentalism in your book and its early beginnings. What was the impact of environmental regulation, or just environmentalism, period, not necessarily the regulation, on the world economy?
Strictly in economic terms here, and I'm not talking about the health benefits of cleaner air or something like that, but strictly in economic terms, environmental protection has a cost. Because when you have to install more pollution equipment in your factory, then that means that there's less money available for new production equipment. You can't upgrade your machinery as often. So there is an effect which tends to slow down the rate of economic growth, slow down the rate of productivity improvement. And I think that's something that we saw very much in the 1970s. Perhaps it's not a bad trade-off, depending upon your views, but it's definitely a trade-off that shows up in the data.
You know, as I read your book and think back on all of the presidents, since 1973, who have run for office, and the nominating conventions when they stand up there and berate the economy, if it was an economy governed by the other party of the last 4 years, or they applaud the economy if, in fact, their party governed during that time frame. I couldn't help but think that the American people have never really been told the full story, it seems. And you mention in your book people like Schiller, Burns, and Priebisch. You can explain to us who they are, but three economists of the era. It does seem, whether it's the economist or the politicians, that the American people don't have a very good understanding of this two-part economy that we've been subjected to since the end of World War II, the post-war boom, and then the settling down of the world economy, where too few American politicians anyway are really willing to tell it like it is, or maybe they don't know themselves.
I think that's right. One of the reasons I think that Americans have had such a high expectation of how quickly their incomes would grow is because they were told during the Golden Age, they were told repeatedly, we can handle this. Government can now control the economy. We can make sure that there's full unemployment. We have the knowledge, the ability to make sure that we don't have any more recessions. And so you can look forward to good times forever. U.S. politicians said that. U.S. economists said that. Walter Heller, who was an advisor to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, said that we had gotten the emotionalism out of economics, that we could now run the economy rationally. And what he meant by that is we could manipulate this and that to make sure everybody always had a job and a rising wage. Well, that promise turned out to be false. It was simply not possible for economists and governments to do that. But certainly, the people don't want to hear that that's false, and no politician is going to admit that that's false. No politician is going to say, you know, folks, I really can't do very much to speed up the rate of long-term economic growth. Okay, that's not a winning platform here. So every politician criticizes his or her predecessor for slow economic growth. If you recall last year's campaign, at one point we had the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign in sort of a bidding war, who could make the greater promise about how fast they'd make the economy grow. I think we got up with Trump to 6% a year. It would be pretty remarkable if the economy grew 6% a year, but that is the way the story is told to the public. So it's natural that the public has very great expectations. The concern that I raise in the book, frankly, is that we're in for disappointment over the long term. One reason I think that we see so much political discontent today, one reason we see so many Americans who are disaffected, is that they expect more from the government on the economic front than the government can possibly deliver. They'd like to see their incomes rising. They'd like to see full employment. And the government just can't guarantee that.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Mark Levinson about his book, An Extraordinary Time, which looks at how the end of the post-war boom reverberated throughout the global economy. I was somewhat amused by the fact that you spent some time in your book talking about these men, Carl Schiller, Arthur Burns, and Raoul Priebisch, as I mentioned earlier, all of whom thought that they could foresee the economy's future but didn't quite step up to it. But it took a woman Alice Rivlin to really nail it down for you in your book. I think you quoted her, and apparently she was the one who was candid enough to say that we don't really know how we're going to move into the future when it comes to improving the economy, and that can be said for almost every country.
Alice Rivlin, for those who don't know her, was the head of the Congressional Budget Office for many years and the head of the Office of Management and Budget. This we're talking now in the Carter administration, roughly that period of time. And her comment that I quote in the book was that you can say we didn't do a good job, but you can't say what we should have done to make it better. And I think that that's really the conundrum that many economic policymakers face today. There are no buttons they can push that are suddenly going to raise the rate of productivity growth. There are no levers. And so I argue that growth in productivity is quite unpredictable, and it really depends on decisions in the private sector over which the government has very little control. Here we're getting back to your initial question about technology and innovation. Productivity growth, which translates into economic growth, really depends on innovation and how innovation is put to use in the private sector. And that's something in general we just don't foresee very well.
But that is certainly something that has everyone's attention right now. The word innovation has become the buzzword on college and university campuses. It's become the buzzword in the economy. And I think everyone is looking for a silver bullet here. And you're saying time will tell.
You're right. And let me just make a statement here that kind of straightens out some confused thinking. Okay, people talk a lot about innovation and how our country is great at innovating. Okay, in economic terms, innovation doesn't matter. What matters is how innovations are put to constructive use in the economy. You can have a great innovation, and if no one finds ways to make use of it, then it really doesn't matter. We've had many examples in our history of how an innovation took 10, 20, 30 years or more to find its way into the economy. Everybody learned in school about Thomas Edison back in the 1870s experimenting with light bulbs, but it was really the 1920s before most U.S. factories were electrified. So there can be very long and unpredictable delays. Some innovations lead to no economic benefits at all. So this is not a situation in which a government can say, hey, we're going to spend an extra $10 billion a year on research and development, and that's going to give us a 3% higher productivity by 2022. It doesn't work like that at all.
How about education and immigration policies? How important are they to this current world economy?
Well, they're very important, but again, I emphasize the unpredictability of this. I think we have a pretty good idea that over time, if the average level of education in our country rises, that that's going to be very positive for productivity growth. But how quickly this is going to show up in a higher wage for one of your listeners, that's a totally different question. And this is a troubling thing, I think, for anyone in political office. You can't say that if we give more college scholarships this year, we're going to have higher productivity 3 years from now. The effects take a while to be felt. They're quite unpredictable. And because we already have quite an educated country, quite an educated society, the effects of improvements in education are going to be small. They're going to be felt a little bit at a time. This doesn't say by any means that education's a bad thing. I think education's an important thing. But it does mean that we're not going to have the great pop in productivity growth that we had after the war when we started with a country where the average education was perhaps eighth or ninth grade and suddenly started sending millions and millions of people through high school and into university. Again, that was the low-hanging fruit that we were able to pick, but now the improvements in education are going to be coming much slower.
When it comes to the developing economies, how do you measure whether or not it may be the developing economies that save the world economy in the sense that they will improve productivity, they will put more people to work, more of their people will be educated, they will contribute more to the economy? Now, I know, having said that, I can go through South America and find some great examples of that, but I can also find some great examples of South American economies that are in disastrous problems right now. So I guess the question is, how does this balance itself out? Can we look forward to a world economy that is improved by virtue of these developing economies stepping up, or are there not enough of them?
I think you just hit the key point there right at the end, that there just aren't enough of them. What enables very, very rapid productivity growth is that an economy has a lot of underutilized resources. That was the situation in the United States and Canada, in Western Europe and Japan at the end of World War II. It's no longer the situation. Since then, we saw Korea boom, and Korea grew very, very rapidly for several decades. Now, Korean economic growth is getting down close to where it is in the United States. We've seen a boom in China. Why? Well, China had lots and lots of underutilized resources. It had tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people moving from low productivity farms to higher productivity jobs in the cities. Well, that's over. And you've seen Chinese economic growth come down from 10% a year to 7% a year to now 6% a year, and it's headed lower. This is just a natural development as economies mature. So I think we have a possibility of some very rapid growth for a while in Africa and in India. And I think it's inevitable that after a period of time, the growth in those countries will slow down. As I describe in my book with the words, an ordinary economy, the normal state of affairs in a mature economy is that it grows 1.5%, 2% a year. That's not bad. And that's really where economies head as they've used up their underutilized resources.
Mark, I'm going to leave it to our listeners to fill in the details. There's much we haven't been able to discuss in your book. Again, its title is An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. Our author is Mark Levinson. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you very much.
Listeners often ask me, where do we get ideas for books and what am I reading? I thought I'd give you a few examples of where we get the ideas and what we're reading. As far as ideas for books, that would be places like Rediscovered Books in Boise, which has a great inventory of bestsellers and books from all genres. I also visit independent bookstores when I'm on the road and an occasional Barnes & Noble store as well. There are some great podcasts that review books, with the New York Times Book Review podcast at the top of my list. I also enjoy the BBC World Book Club with Harriet Gilbert, who does a fine job interviewing authors from around the world about their best-known novels. In addition to the books that do make Reader's Corner, I read others that may never get to an interview with the author simply because it's not always easy to connect with an author in some remote part of the world, such as the case with a book I'm reading now entitled Dance of the Jacaranda by Peter Kamani of Kenya. It's a fictional account of lives involved in the building of the railroad across Kenya that heralded the birth of the nation. It was a railroad that was constructed at the outset of the 20th century by Indians, Brits, and Kenyans, but mainly Indians who were imported from India to Kenya to build that railroad. Speaking of books with an international flavor, the book I'm recommending to everyone these days is A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. It's a tale of a Russian aristocrat in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution who is sentenced to house arrest in the Hotel Metropole, where he is forced to live in the attic after living in one of the hotel's most spacious and luxurious apartments during the glory days of Tsar rule. Every time I open that book, I am transported back to the Russia of the 1920s and all it conjures up in imagination and reality. Although I do not know where this book is going since I haven't finished it yet, I'm told by friends that I'm in for a great read until the very end. And this is one book that may just get to Reader's Corner. Amor Towles lives in New York City, so we should be able to figure out a way to get an interview with him. That's all for now. Go out and buy a book and visit a local library. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, you'll find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can also download our free app from Google Play or the App Store to listen to previous interviews anytime.